Today we are going to talk a little about the sacred powers of healing, and the session after this, which I've forgotten if it's tomorrow or the next day, will be about how to help in the healing process. And then for our last session this week on Saturday morning, we'll talk about ritual and healing, including some of the, traditional theological messages that we need to think about in the lives of people healing from physical and sexual abuse. I want to start a little bit this morning by speaking out of my own experience. The title, Sacred Powers of Healing, may be one that does not ring in a kind of ordinary and conventional way on many of your ears, and it doesn't on mine either. And I guess I just want to say a word or two about why I choose that as a title or a theme for us to work together with. And for me, that always means telling a little bit about my journey. I need to let you know that I grew up in a sort of ordinary Lutheran context. I shared in our earlier session that in the early 70s, I began to realize I'd grown up in a home where there was battering. I also maybe need to say to you that I grew up in a context where there was sexual abuse by my father. And at the time when my father began abusing me, I began running away from home. I did a number for a couple of years with juvenile delinquents. I learned how to do things like steal and how to make brass knuckles out of forks, siphon gas out of cars. I got caught stealing in a Woolworths, and I got sent to my pastor. My pastor gave me a very fine, and I'm sure very accurate, theological lecture on the commandment, thou shalt not steal. he never asked why I had been stealing at Woolworths. I suspect he didn't want to know. I maybe couldn't have told him, even if I had been asked. It was a very effective lecture. I stopped running around with juvenile delinquents. I started running around with fundamentalists. for some mixed reasons. But in the process of that sort of back and forthing from, you know, incipient criminal to fundamentalist, very righteous, don't smoke, don't dance, don't drink, don't go to movies or you'll go to hell, I heard a lot of things that were sort of discontinuous in my mind. And one of them was that the world was created in 4004 BC. That's what it said in the King James Version. And I had been taking biology and evolution along the way, and I just could not fathom why anyone would want to say the world was created in 4004, right? And in that context of that sort of evangelical fervor, there was a lot of discussion about your faith will make you whole. There was a lot of evangelical rhetoric about faith healing, and I recall hearing a radio evangelist talking about the power of God to make you well and, you know, faith, and he said something like, put your hands on the radio and feel the vibrations. And I, who was a good student and did a lot of science, just could not fathom the idea that there was... Right, I mean, I was a secular person. I was a good, I believed in science as a way of finding out the truth about our world. I did great stuff in biology. I wanted to be a doctor. So that I started out in a place where I would never have talked about something like the sacred powers of healing. And it has only been the subsequent chapters of my story when I, as an adult, learned to say, to claim for myself that I wanted to heal. And as I began to work in direct service with survivors of sexual assault and abuse or of battering, and I saw the transformations that occurred in their lives, just as had occurred in my life, that I began to say, there is something very deep in this healing process. I began to reclaim healing as a theological or spiritual reality. And I was reminded of lots of good traditional messages, like Jesus always telling the disciples to preach and to heal. And I never have gotten clear about whether or not the healings that they did in those stories were supernatural or not, but as I claim the sacred powers of healing that are afoot in the lives of survivors, I need to tell you a few things about clearing away what that means. First of all, I don't believe today that it means something supernatural. It might mean something supernatural for some people, but for me and for the ordinary experiences of survivors, it's not like having something come into the universe from outside it. It's a very ordinary process and connected to ordinary capacities that we all have. When I talk about the sacred powers of healing, I do not mean that they are magic powers. I do not mean that we will do a little incantation, say some words over you, and effortlessly and immediately healing will happen. No fairy godmothers, no magic wands, as one book about healing after rape says. But the sacredness is not opposed to the hard work and the effort that go on in the healing process. I also want to say, thirdly, that there's not some esoteric quality that happens when we're talking about the sacred powers of healing. You don't need to go to medical school and get an MD. You don't need a PhD in something. You don't need arcane training. This is perfectly ordinary stuff. But I do want to say that although what I mean by sacred here is not that it's magic, not that it's supernatural, not that it's esoteric, I want to affirm that it is sacred, that it is religious, and that what I mean by that is that we are being in touch with that which is most worthy to be cherished and most worthy to be reverenced in human experience. That's a window, if you like, to what traditional Christian theology has often spoken about as the divine. I'm not sure always whether it's the divine, because I'm not sure what all survivors would say about that. But as I've thought about sacred powers more and more, I believe that there are many, many sacred powers in the universe that we often don't notice that they're there, but that in a sense they are what keeps us alive and what calls us to be what we might be, or to find or discover or create meaning. And if I were going to do a whole systematic theology here, I might want to talk about something like creation and the doctrine of creation that we have often used in the tradition. I'd want to say God made us with recuperative powers. It's a sort of ordinary miracle that if you break your leg, you don't die from it. Your body has the power to recover from that wound. If you have an emotional trauma, you don't go crazy necessarily. Your psyche or your spirit has the ability to recuperate from that. Let me also say that when I talk about healing here, I don't mean going back to normal. We often talk about healing as though it was recovering something, that is going back to what it was before this traumatic experience happened. Often survivors want healing to be going back. And unhappily, the kinds of abuses that we're talking about here are not ones that you can recover from in the sense of going back, but you can be recreated in the process. So it's those of you who were at Matins on Monday morning, Barbara Rossing speaking about the eighth day of creation, we human beings have a little trickle of God's power of creation in our ability to recreate and make something new, something whole, after immense pain and damage and woundedness. So that's a little prolegomena. Does that make sense to people? Does that sit well? Does that seem odd? Does it seem irrelevant? What do you have some responses?
Well, in other words, what you're saying is sometimes there's scarring.
There is scarring, yes. That's right. You might get a cut in your arm, grows back together again. You can use the arm again, but the scar will be there. And you will always, in a sense, be reminded of the wound. But it's a whole arm again.
There, if you follow that analogy, though, that scar. scar tissue is stronger than the healthier tissue. There is strength in the healing.
Often. Yeah. That's right. Now, that's not a universal rule. We know that some wounds leave lasting weakness and a sort of sense of needing to cope with that. But very frequently that can be true. And often survivors do say that they feel that they are stronger or more in touch because of the new things that have happened in the process.
I think what's so scary about that, even the scariness about being healed, is that one anticipates being reshaped.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a new world for us.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that in the grieving process too, that's what's so scary, that mm-hmm. you know that you are going to change, and then you don't know if you're going to be able to handle that change.
Mm-hmm.
But the healing is there, and it's a reshaped
mm-hmm.
personhood that one actually has.
Mm-hmm. That resonates a lot with my experience, Sammy. After leaving home and, you know, going to college and getting married and going to graduate school and all these things, and beginning to get into therapy, at one point I realized that I was terrified of therapy, because at least even though I knew I was damaged, at least I was familiar with the damage. And that if I was going to become whole or claim healing, it meant I had to change and I had to go into some unfamiliar territory. It was very scary. Mm-hmm.
What turned you around? I mean, what do you remember? What little cost you to turn around from saying you said you ran away and you stole some things and so forth? What happened? Was it therapy, or was it your church? Or what turned you around that it became successful? And so many people don't go your way, they keep going deeper and deeper into trouble. And I was wondering, what was your, for you, that turned you around?
Mm-hmm. I would name many different ingredients in that process. And it was a long, slow process. In some ways, I claim today that I am whole and that I need still to be healed. So that I don't want to say that this process is over for me. I would name, in my personal story, I think I don't want to claim any extra special merit on my part that I have gotten to the place that I am. Accident was a very large portion of my healing journey. I happened to be in a place where people were talking about battering. I happened to meet a therapist when I was going into one of the pits of craziness in my life. It just happened one day, surely by accident, that I was in a meeting where a number of people went around the room to say who they were, and someone across the room said she was a therapist, a socialist, she worked with battered women. And this was in 1976 or 75, and I'd never heard of a therapist who did this. And I lost everything else, and I somehow managed to keep a hold of her telephone number and called her. And that was one of the places where I took a definite turn in my process.
See, I don't think that was an accident. That was God at work. That's what I think.
I agree with that.
Yes.
But I also say it was an accident. That the grace of God and accidents in our lives are not... I don't have a notion of providence in the sense of God directing all the little turns and twists in our lives. But that God is present in the depths of the accidents.
Mm-hmm.
Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Because I don't want to have a sense that there's somebody throwing dice about my life. Or magic wanding, sort of. I think that some of you look like you may be a little perplexed by this. I think we have a distinction in the tradition between notions of grace and notions of providence. Providence often meant predestination. Remember all those discussions about whether God knew, foreknew from the beginning, whether or not you were going to be saved and was sort of in control of whether you would be or not. I want to leave that predestination factor aside, because I think it makes God into a great controller. And I think the future's open, even to God. Someone else wanted to add back here.
I have no problems with you saying that God works immediately rather than immediately, in fact, I would press it all the way that he does usually use very ordinary means. Mm-hmm. But that's the positive. I think when you press that too far, there are some very negative overtones, and that is, if we have these healing powers within, then the wounded might feel even worse. At least some wounded might feel even worse because mm-hmm. they're not being healed, and they're saying, you know, I think they could dig a deeper hole for themselves. If I have these healing powers within, obviously I must not be using them.
Very possibly. And we need to talk a little bit about what some of the specifics are as I name them, I think, in order to deal with that issue. Can you hold that and bring it back around? That would be important. Go ahead.
Tying into what you just said, though, I think initially, before anyone can seek help or look for healing, they have to see that glimmer of hope. It has to surface mm-hmm. somewhere before they can go further and reverse the directions.
And in the tradition, there was a theological name for this, oddly enough. It was called prevenient grace, meaning the grace that comes before the fullness of grace that lets you know that you need it. Right? I mean, prevenient grace is always at work in the process to let you know that you need help, or that in the tradition it was that you were a sinner. The grace brought you to the knowledge that you were a sinner, so that you needed grace. And there's a sense of that mysterious but ever-present working of God's grace, sometimes making you realize you're in despair. Doesn't always, that action of grace does not always have a happy ending. Sometimes it could push you further into despair. Go ahead.
This is a little off to the side on the God's grace part of it, but I took a class from Lou Tice, and one of the things that he propounds in there is that once you've set a goal and your mind is fixed on, for instance, you want to heal, then you will pick up from all your surroundings. All these messages are coming to you every day, but the day that you decide you want to be healed, then you will see the possibilities for healing, the people who will help. When, if you hadn't been to that point, you wouldn't have picked up on that lady.
I think there's a truth in that, but my experience was sort of different. My experience was that it was saying, I want to heal, was a cry of desperation. And that, in fact, I felt worse after I said it because I didn't believe I could. There were all these other people around me healing, and I wanted desperately to heal, but I really didn't believe that it was possible for me. And desperation is often one of those little click movements. And it doesn't, I mean, this is not a continual, this is another thing we maybe should say as a preliminary way. The healing process after abuse is not a continual upward journey. It is not a gradual slope upward. And it's important, I think, to clear this one away, because we have these notions of progress that came to us out of some of our history, that progress is ever upward. It's going upward sort of gradually, like stair steps or up a hill. And in fact, experientially, it's much more like mountains, right? It's, you go up a ways and then you sink down into a pit. And it may be that you sink further into the pit than you had been before, because it's not linear. It's not a linear upward process. You can find yourself recycling things and going further down, and you think that you've gotten worse, but in fact you've moved a step forward. But it often doesn't compute in the linear way we think about things.
When you're feeling worse because you're dealing with it and you're not denying it.
Exactly.
That's why you feel worse.
Uh-huh.
Say it again.
You're feeling worse because you're dealing with the hurt rather than denying it. And once you start dealing with that hurt, you start to climb up, and then you just go right back down again. But it is always onward and upward, even with the pit.
Yeah, the onward and upward part is an image I don't feel comfortable with because it doesn't fit in my journey, but it might fit in yours.
Mm-hmm. I know I did not seek help until the desperation point. Mm-hmm. And this business about falling in the hole and seeing people heal because they are open to realize they can heal themselves, I had to get down to that hole.
Mm-hmm.
And I had the same experience you did. I was in the right place at the right time and met a therapist, although it was a year before I called her.
Yeah.
I never lost her telephone number.
Mm-hmm.
And even though I had only 4 months,
mm-hmm.
the healing came about in a very, very quick time because I was ready for it.
Ready is the important word there. And let me just say that this is another place that I would like to have somebody do some theology one day. There is a very mysterious and wonderful thing about readiness to heal that is foundational to all that I think that we need to work with here. People heal when they are ready to heal. They do not heal before they are ready. You cannot push them to be ready before they are ready. And this is a very important part for us to think about when we want to help people to heal. Because those of us who are lovers or loved ones of people who need to heal often have a lot of desire to say, hurry up and fix it. Mm-hmm. Hurry up and get well. And the fact is that the timing of healing and the readiness for healing is something over which no one has control. And when I think experientially again about images here, I often think about the dual processes of childbirth. Because the preparation, the long hours of childbirth, are related to the dilation of the cervix. It is an involuntary process. You have no control over it. And if you start pushing before you're ready to push, you get into pain, agony, and damage. I mean, so literally, you spend many hours of the childbirth process holding back from effort. Because it is involuntary. It's something that happens inside you. The moment when you're ready to push, then pushing feels great and is very helpful. But before that time, pushing is counterproductive. The same is true, I think, about readiness to heal. You cannot make someone ready to heal before they are ready. And that readiness comes up flowing from below. And readiness guides every stage of the process. People deal with material when they are ready to deal with it. And in fact, sometimes when we get into greater despair because we're at another level of pain, it's because we are now ready to deal with that level of pain. So there's a sense in which you have strengthened resources that bring up a deeper level of pain because you're ready to.
I wanted to add one thing to that, and that is about forgiveness, because I think we in the church carry a great deal of guilt when we're told to forgive.
Yes.
You have to be ready to forgive.
Uh-huh. That's right. Amen.
That was one of the most important lessons that I learned, that it takes time to get to the readiness to forgive.
Yes.
I'm kind of interested in, are you going to be talking about what happens to a person after being sexually abused? You're talking about healing in general, that's fine.
Okay.
But I would really be interested to know, uh-huh, what are some of the dynamics that go on if you're into,
yeah,
healing and therapy? What are some of the ways that you are healed? What is happening?
Mm-hmm.
You see?
All right, there are a couple of different sets of concepts here. One is that most of the movement, that is to say the rape crisis movement or the sexual assault movement or the battered women's movement, works with a small fourfold paradigm that I find very useful. Let me just name the four stages of the process. First stage is the crisis stage, in which you feel overwhelmed by what's happened. You may be shaking, you may have adrenaline coursing, you're in a crisis. People can express their crisis either in an expressed way. We all know what someone in the expressed style looks like when they're in crisis. They may be crying, they may be shouting, they may be not in control, they may be shaking. But there's another way of expressing, of dealing with the crisis stage, and that is in a controlled way, in which someone is hyperlucid, very calm, not shaking, answering questions in perfect coherence. It's hard for the rest of us to realize that this person is also in a crisis phase. Because maybe it's because of the different way our bodies react to adrenaline. Maybe, I mean, who knows why that is. And the second stage of the healing process is denial. After the crisis phase, and who knows how long any of these phases last, by the way, they may last a couple of hours or many years. Denial, the sense of trying to get back to normal, in the sense of going back now, making life just the way it was before, not thinking about it, not dealing with it, is a second phase of the healing process, and it's real important for us to remember this. Although it looks to many of us, seeing a victim or a survivor, that they are now not dealing with the process, that denial phase is an important part. The third phase is called the processing phase, and we'll get to some specifics of what happens in the processing phase. Processing is often brought on by that readiness business we talked about earlier. And it can be very odd or strange what kind of accidents bring people out of denial into readiness or processing. People might see a television movie about sexual abuse. They might have an anniversary of the assault. They might be at a life transition stage, getting a promotion, getting married. They might smell a smell that they smelled during the assault or the abuse, and it triggers something in them. They might start flashbacking or do nightmares. Whatever it is, processing is part of what we'll spend a little more time about. And then the fourth phase of the healing process is called integration. And we often say that there are two important signs of integration. One is that the anger is appropriately directed at the assailant and not at the self. And the second is that one neither obsesses about nor represses the trauma. So you don't have to process it all day, all the time, and neither do you have to deny it. But it's integrated into your life as a fact that's caused pain and caused growth, that's part of you. But in a sense, you have let go of the power of it to direct your life. Okay? So it doesn't mean forgetting that this happened to you. It doesn't mean pretending that you were never in this painful place. But it means really integrating it into the rest of your life. Now let's just talk a little bit about what happens in the processing phase. And I want to use some of these activities that go on with people to chime into my sense of what some specifics in those sacred powers of healing are. The very first of them is disclosing. It's telling someone about the experience. People do not heal until there is disclosure. They go into crisis, they go into denial, and they get stopped there. And often, for people who are not yet in the processing phase or who have not disclosed, they may flip in and out between crisis and denial many times a day. Some of the therapists who work with incest victims, for instance, say it is not unusual for an incest victim to flashback and deny, flashback and repress 25, 30 times a day. So that there's a serious turmoil process that's going on. Disclosure, telling someone about it, I don't either know why disclosure is essential, but I think it's another place I want to do theology, right? I want to start talking about the depth of human sociability, that there's something important about the companionship of the other person with you in that experience that unleashes those recuperative powers we talked about. We often forget when we Christians talk about being created in the image of God, we act as though we were created in the image of God one by one. But we're created all together. We're created as a community, as people who need each other in very deep foundational ways. God said, let's create human beings in our image. Right? It's a plural we're talking about there. We are plural by our very nature, and when we touch into that sociability or community or whatever, that opens the door to healing. A second real important part of that is remembering what happened. Remembering in a safe place. Not exactly the same as flashbacking into the crisis, but somehow in the process of talking with someone who is safe, we'll maybe should talk a little bit more about what safety is, but it is the reliving of the incidents in a safe place and being able to process the experience at one's own pace that is one of the fundamental ingredients of healing that occurs. I want to say, remembering is a sacred power. In denying, we often try to forget. I spend a lot of time in my young adulthood trying to forget where I came from, what had happened to me. And it was in the process of that initial therapy when I sat down and started to say, this is what my life was like. And you remember what you're able to remember very frequently. Remember what you're ready to remember. And as you remember it in a safe place where the feelings are validated and the reality is validated, that integration into your life happens. Remembering is a sacred power, very ordinary power that we all can be in touch with. Another one of those is, someone has mentioned grieving here, and I think I want to talk about the sacred power of tears and the sacred power of anger, fundamental to what happens when people are in the healing process. People weep. People, in fact, being able to weep about what happened is often a sign that you've done some healing and that the tears are pulling forth more healing from you. Being able to feel the feelings instead of numbing out to them is another part of that grieving process, that sense of deep pain, of being able to experience that and respond to it in the way that deep pain needs to be experienced. Sometimes people will cry in agony, sometimes they will, deep guttural shouts will come forth from them. At some points along the way, I've gone out to my car and closed up the garage, closed all the windows of the car, and bellowed just deeply from the center of myself in a kind of combined pain and anger. Grieving is something we talk often about in the church these days. Are there some things you want to add or disagree with or touch upon about either remembering or grieving or disclosing in all this? Go ahead.
Well, I can only think of my own case since I've been through the grieving process, but I received as a gift a magazine called Theos. They heal, they help each other spiritually, and it's a kind of an interdenominational, non-denominational magazine. But it was a great help to me in that they were very realistic about suggestions, and one of those was that at anniversaries or times when one is in deep despair, one of the healing things to do is to pull out all the memorabilia about that person. And this last March 5th, on my husband's 4th anniversary of his death, I decided to do that. And I sat in my house coat from 10 in the morning. I pulled out every letter and card that people had
sent to me at the time of his illness and death. Mm-hmm. And I was still sitting there at 4 o'clock.
Mm-hmm.
And I cried my heart out. There was nobody else in the house. All my kids were gone.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't express mm-hmm. what that remembering did for me mm-hmm. in a very real way.
Mm-hmm.
It is a healing process. Mm-hmm. And I think sometimes to deliberately move into that remembering
mm-hmm.
Is a real helpful thing mm-hmm. to do.
That's a very wonderful example, Sammy. It's not, makes very perfect sense to me in terms of what you were ready to do at that time. It's maybe the specifics of it are not so applicable to what happens to people who have been through traumatic violence. Because we, even in a normal state, even in my state of wholeness I am now in, I would not intentionally sit down to recall all of those things about the trauma I experienced. And that's okay, because I don't want to put myself into that place of chaos right now. But that reliving parts of it in a place that is safe, and I guess I want to emphasize the safety of the place. Now, what makes a safe place? What makes a safe place for those of you who have been in pain? We all know what a safe place is. We all have some bits of that knowledge in us.
Well, the lack of a threat to the person.
Lack of a threat. Some others.
For me, a safe place is to go to the bathroom, run in the bathtub full of nice warm water, and just lay back.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh. That's a nurturing place.
To be with someone that loves you.
That's right.
Uh-huh. Most important, I think.
Non-judgmental acceptance.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, very important.
Somebody believes me.
Somebody believes me.
Mm-hmm. Someone else has been through the same kind of experience.
Mm-hmm. The understanding that comes. Mm-hmm. Did you, someone up here?
The freedom of being interrupted. In other words, that you do not fear that you're going to be interrupted.
Good.
Mm-hmm. I was thinking of the importance of, as a friend or as a person in contact, when we're in contact with other people, the importance of, in our homes, bringing from people inviting to our homes into the social occasion, of the goal of creating a safe place, because you never know what kind of pain that person comes into your home mm-hmm. is carrying.
Mm-hmm.
And you never know what that touch may have mm-hmm. done to help give them some freedom
mm-hmm.
to heal,
mm-hmm.
even though it's just over for coffee.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Others want to add? I think the two parts of those that I want especially emphasize and reinforce from what you've said are the sense of being believed is very foundational to the experience of survivors, because often survivors are afraid that they're not going to be believed, that the story that you tell is shocking in some way or surprising or overturns some taken for granted notions. A real fine example is the woman who is battered by a husband who's the president of a church council, who is afraid that if she talks to the pastor or anyone in the church, that they're not going to believe her because they all know the person. And they're going to say, oh, he couldn't do that. He just couldn't have done that. He couldn't imagine. I can't imagine him doing that. And sometimes when we are deeply pained or shocked by something, then we now in our culture have slang that just says, I just can't believe it, right? I just couldn't believe it. And we really mean to say something like, oh, that was so hard, you know? That's so painful. But we say, I can't believe it, or I couldn't believe it. And those phrases are just ring death knells in the ears of survivors because they're afraid you're attacking their credibility. So always to assure someone that you believe them. And that I think about that as something like the sacred power of affirmation. And in fact, this is your reality. You are the guide to this reality. You know this reality better than I do. I'm sort of at a loss to think about how to talk about that. But another part of it is to have the feelings validated. If I say, I'm frightened, and you respond, oh no, you're not. Or if I say, I'm frightened, and you say, oh, but you look so calm, you're denying my reality. You're invalidating what I'm telling you. And so a real important part of that safe place is to the acceptance, is to validate those feelings, even if they make you real uncomfortable. And they often, those feelings that survivors have, make the rest of us uncomfortable. If a battered woman says, I want to kill him, it's not an easy thing for someone listening to accept. It makes us all real, you know, nervous. What if she really does go out and kill him? Go ahead.
I was just going to say that I think one of the things that's so important about being believed is that the survivor, him or herself, has such a hard time believing that it really happened.
Mm-hmm.
That's part of that struggle of coming out of the denial.
Yes.
Because society just, I mean, that just doesn't happen. You look out and you see all these normal people and you think, well, you know, it just doesn't happen. And yet there are these memories and these flashbacks, and
mm-hmm.
so it's such a struggle to believe that it actually could happen when,
mm-hmm.
when you know, the perpetrator was such an upstanding citizen or something
yep.
like that. And so I think it's a little bit of craziness within the person's own mind. And
absolutely.
To have that non-believability reflected back
mm-hmm.
reinforces the craziness. Or to have
mm-hmm.
the assertion that yes, it did happen reflected back helps
mm-hmm.
the person find some sense of stability and security.
Yes, yes, that's very true. And the other part about that is when we're in that denial phase, and pushing it down and saying maybe it really didn't happen, maybe I made it all up, maybe I imagined it. The other part that's going on inside the survivor is that the pain is being minimized. Well, so I was terrified, you know, and I smile or I grin as I say this. It's a way of my not feeling the feeling. It's a defense mechanism in a way to keep us from breaking open. But a safe place is one in which the minimizing of the pain is not, you don't collude in a sense. If someone says, well, it really hurt, but I went on to do this, and then you sort of say, I hear you saying it really hurt, you know? So that the pain that you're hearing gets validated in a way that often can help the person to open it up and feel it for themselves. You wanted to add.
They've done studies about adult children and alcoholics,
mm-hmm.
and one of the struggles that the people have in those situations is that they grow up in an abnormal situation, but they think it's normal.
Uh-huh.
Does this same
uh-huh.
kind of dynamic happen in a home where children are
mm-hmm.
abused?
Yes. Uh-huh. Very definitely.
So that they believe that this is what all my friends are going through, or this is life, normal life?
Well, let me just answer you experientially from my own story. I was sort of divided about this and very, very confused. And this is a normal reaction, by the way, and to the situation, because it is confusing, and the confusing messages are part of the power dynamic that goes on. So on the one hand, yes, I believe that this was just how life was. It was going to be the pits. It was going to be shit. And I didn't want to get anywhere near anything that would. On the other hand, I also thought it was so abnormal and so shameful, and that no one else was experiencing this, that I thought it was uniquely wicked on the part of my family, and that no one else could be like this. Does this make sense? It's this confusing thing about the world is really like this, and somehow it's only us, and everyone else is fine. So that's some of that same dynamic that goes on with adult children of alcoholics. Did you want to add to this?
Well, yeah, it tied in a lot with what he just asked. We went through a course of, I don't know if anyone else has been dealing with adopting small children who have been through, you know, we're looking into it. So we've been through a series of classes, and they brought really strongly brought out there that the reason that sexual and physical abuse is so predominant now is because we're going into a second and third generation of people who, when they were children and they were being abused, were not believed. Mm-hmm. They would go to adults and tell, and they'd go, no, you're making that up, you're lying to me, nobody, you know, that wouldn't happen to you. And so these children grew up, mm-hmm. and when they got to adulthood, they started having children, mm-hmm. with the predominant impression that it's okay now, yeah. because it was not believed, and this was done to me, therefore I can do it to my children, and it's an okay norm in society. Mm-hmm. And so these children who are now adults are doing it to their children, and it's just snowballing in our society.
Let me just add one little flicker in there that's hard to deal with. When kids are abused, young especially, they are often told that it's normal. The behavior is both that it's normal and that this is silence, we must not talk about it, and silence about it is normal. But often when especially sexually abused kids reach their teen years, they begin to have little bits of reality come in to say, hey, this isn't normal. 13-year-old girls who are hearing their, or 12-year-old girls who are hearing other girls talk about kissing for the first time, begin to be aware that everyone else is not having the kinds of experiences at home that they're having. And one result is that they might start to act out. They're calling for help, but they don't know how to call for help in a way that the rest of us are prepared to hear. And so they may run away from home, steal from the Woolworths, go around with juvenile delinquents. And because you're acting bad, and sometimes you're acting bad because you feel like you're bad, right? So if I'm this bad, I'm going to act bad. What happens to the people who run around stealing cars, doing drugs, doing alcohol, staying home from school, getting pregnant, being sexually active? What happens to those teens?
Sort of ostracized.
We say they're bad. And what happens if a teen who is running away from home, you know, sleeping with people, screaming at her parents, acting out in school, says, my father is diddling me at home? What's our response? You know, she's just bad. That's why she's saying these things. So often it is, as people begin to perceive the normal, not normal stuff, and they, especially in the teen years, begin to ask for help, and we don't know how to hear that. They're crying, help, help, help. You know, some twists and turns that are not happy can occur. Did you want to add?
Yeah, I just wanted to say, I think this is a special message for the church. I met a woman here a couple of weeks ago who had been abused from the age of 5 to 16. And by the entire family, uncles and brother and father, and physically by the mother, it was only the hope of the grandmother. But I asked her were they church people? She said, oh, absolutely. She said they went to church every Sunday. And I think that our churches have, in their theology, have not been prepared to deal with darkness. I mean, I call that darkness. And we always have the salve, somehow, if you only would believe a little stronger in that Jesus who heals, we have those immediate salving answers. And I wonder why seminaries don't offer special courses in this kind of thing, mm-hmm. in the whole aspect of abuse within the parishes. Mm-hmm. I think we need to do that. Mm-hmm. We are not hearing the brokenness and the pain of people.
Mm-hmm. But if it's for the church, then it's not for the clergy.
Say some more.
The clerics can't do it all. Mm-hmm. It's a community. Mary said it before. Mm-hmm. And I don't disagree And I just want to emphasize, it's not just for your clergy. We're in this thing together. I love this. I heard it from Joseph Campbell, as an old Irish saying. Is this a private fight or can anybody get in it? We're in it together. Don't bag it all on the clergy.
If you don't mind, I would like to just piggyback on that to say that there is another sacred power at foot here in all of this process of healing, and that is empowerment. Empowerment, which is to say affirming the power that comes up from inside, affirming the powers that you already have, respecting, cherishing, loving, asking, nurturing them. And that is a deep part of what occurs with all kinds of survivors. Their power has been trampled on. They have had their power wrested from them. They have been rendered helpless. And that helplessness, that sense of being at the behest or being in the power of someone else who can hurt me, who can harm me, who can tell me lies, who can coerce me, that often it's that power disorder that is among the most damaging parts of what goes on with survivors. And so when you're creating a safe space for someone, you want to be deeply cherishing of their power. That's, in a sense, what all of this sense of the healing power of victims is about. It is about the victim has the power to heal within her. It's not you healing that person. It's their healing up from within themselves. And it is respecting their power of choice, which has been trampled, smashed. So, for instance, when a client might come in to do some support counseling, often, for instance, the very first thing, if you're a counselor, you want to do is to say, would you like to sit in this chair or in that chair? You want to offer them a choice right at the beginning and affirm their choice. Their choice is their choice, and you're there to support their choice. You're not there to tell them to do something else. Because when you get into a power number, telling them what to do, you're doing exactly what the abusive person did. You're using the power of domination, not the power of mutuality and the power of respect. That is, so there's something there about the fact that we are equal in power and that there is a movement of empowerment that needs to occur when someone has had a deep experience of disempowerment. God respects this person's power. God, who is powerful, creates us in God's image, which means we also have powers that we need to cherish, that we need to affirm in this process. And that's an important aspect of that safety and of that healing that goes on. That sense of deep love and respect and reverence for the powers of each other.
I'm a therapist that works with people who are abused, and a way that exactly what you're talking about, another way that it seems to me is a matter of space. Because one of the things that happens to people who are abused is that their personal space is totally obliterated. Nothing, and also is assaulted, nothing belongs to them.
Yes.
Their body does not belong to them.
Yes.
Their life does not belong to them if they're a child. Nothing, they can hang on to nothing. Their space is totally violated, the space of their body and also their psychological space. And so one of the things that's really important in creating a safe place is allowing them to occupy some space. That means that the companion or the therapist is present with them, but does not push an agenda or does not violate the space that they need to do whatever they need to do. And that enables that power, their own power, to begin to emerge. It's a very, very, very important, very subtle, and it is a kind of a sacred thing for the first time of coming out and beginning to speak who they are and beginning to discover that they can be a person that occupies space that is their own, that they can own and they can begin to live their own life.
And it's very beautiful to see that beginning to happen.
And a very frightening thing oftentimes, because whenever they've tried that before, especially as a child, they've been stepped on.
Yes.
And I think with teenagers, that's one of the things that they're crying out to do when they're acting out, is they're trying to carve out some space for them. And if they can just be heard and accepted, even if they are acting out, that's, and if they can be seen that that's not the bottom line with them, they're not a bad kid. What they're doing, perhaps, is inappropriate. But if they can realize that they can have a space that nobody's going to take away from them, then oftentimes the need to act out disappears because they gain what it is they fight.
That's very wonderful to say. Did you want to speak in the back?
No.
You had your hand up this way. Darius.
I just think that you might want to mention, or I'll mention, that wonderful resource that you and others put together, that book on this whole topic, that if we're dealing with clergy in the church, we may be interested in reading further. Not available in books.
Go ahead and mention it.
I don't know. You know it. So I'm asking you to share it.
I put, I and two other women put together an anthology called Sexual Assault and Abuse, a handbook for clergy and religious professionals, which includes some articles about basic facts and dynamics, some articles about theological and religious stuff, and maybe half the book is about how to be present with someone in the healing process in an effective way. Harper and Row, 1987, I think.
Blue cover, if I remember
right. What's your name
then? Yeah, my name is Pellauer. Pellauer, Chester, and Boyadjian. It's not going to win any title competitions.
Well, what did you find this
name? I think you could ask a bookstore to order it if they don't have a copy.
Question.
Yeah?
I was going to say, how can we, in the community, be part of that sacred healing power without getting people messed up because we don't know what to do?
If you're going, you're leaving, aren't you? That's right. You won't be there when I do this whole session about helping. I think that the important thing to remember is that you don't need to be a therapist. Mm-hmm. Some people do need specialized, what I will speak of as specialized companionship in certain dimensions of that process, especially if they've somaticized things, if they, for instance, if they're anorexic, if they're self-mutilating, if they have multiple personality disorder, which we now know is a frequent response to all this, those people need specialized companionship. But by and large and on the whole, these issues are not medical issues. You don't have to go to med school. Anybody can make a safe space. You can make a safe space. We know today about these things because survivors told us about them. It's survivors who have the expertise necessary. And the best thing that you can do if you're nervous about your, you know, ability to deal with the technicalities here is just to remember to listen. To listen in a respectful way. And when you have a chance to say something, to validate the feeling, to take it seriously. And I would also maybe add to be confidential, that is to say, part of empowerment is to say that the right to tell this story is your right. I'm not going to tell this story to anyone else, because it's your story, it belongs to you.